and welcome to Alliance Manchester Business School's Original Thinking Podcast. Today's podcast was recorded at our Teddy Chester lecture. This annual lecture marks the contribution of Teddy Chester, who was the first Professor of Social Administration at the University of Manchester. Professor Chester was an influential pioneer in management development, using evidence and research with policymakers and working with clinical leaders.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Professor Stuart Hyde, Deputy Head of Alliance Manchester Business School. And I'm delighted to welcome you all here this evening. So this is our Teddy Chester lecture, and it gives me particular pleasure to welcome our guest speaker, Bernie Carey. She's going to be talking about the emergence and public awareness of healthcare science, and we're delighted that you've been able to come here to deliver the lecture in person this evening. Our speaker today, Bernie Carey, is head of the National School of Healthcare Science, NSHCS. She's also an associate fellow at Green Templeton College, University of Oxford, and visiting professor at Oxford Brookes University. The NSHCS operates as the national deanery for the training of all scientists in the NHS nationally, where Bernie has led on the training and education of healthcare science workforce since 2017. Since then, the numbers of NHS scientists trained across master's and doctoral level programmes has doubled, and the numbers of scientific speciality traineeships has also grown considerably. This year, Bernie was recognised for her work, including leading the continuation of scientific training during the COVID pandemic by the award of an honorary fellowship of the Institute of Biomedical Science and a Lifetime Achievement Award for Excellence in Healthcare Science from NHS England's Office of the Chief Scientific Officer. Today's lecture will be facilitated by Anne Mahon, Professor of Healthcare of Health Leadership and the head of the Health Management Group here at AMBS.
So I want to say thank you very much, particularly to Professor Naomi Chambers who invited me to give this lecture, but to all of the colleagues and people, particularly Stuart and Anne, who made such lovely comments. Thank you very much. It's a real honour to be here, and I'm absolutely delighted to be giving the 2022 annual Teddy Chester lecture. I'm going to talk about the emergence of healthcare science as a profession in the NHS. And this has really happened over the last 15 years. I have four aims this evening. My first aim is to tell you about an NHS workforce who are they're so well hidden and they're so quietly efficient in what they do as to be almost invisible. This small but critical workforce consists entirely of scientists, and we know them as healthcare scientists. And I think it's important that you understand that, you know, quite a lot of these scientists, particularly those that undertake the HSST programme, they end up being as highly qualified and even, you know, just as skilled as senior medical consultants, and they lead clinical departments and indeed whole divisions in hospitals. I hope to tell you, and I hope to persuade you by the end of this talk, about the vital role that these guys play in patient care, particularly in diagnostics and particularly in some forms of treatment. And in doing so, I'm going to take you on the journey that they've been on over the last 15 years and the journey that they actually still are on. So much of the kind of the health policies and a lot of the kind of background to the, what I'm going to tell you, I'm going to tell you a story about healthcare scientists, but a lot of the kind of background for it, you can find in the chapter that I've co-written with my colleague, Dr. Simon Morley, and it's going to be published in a book coming out next year, the Research Handbook on Leadership, which is edited by Naomi Chambers. Okay, so those are my aims, and I hope I'll achieve them. And the outline of my talk, just so you can keep tabs on me, is I'm going to tell a little bit about who the healthcare scientists are, and then I'm going to just really briefly touch on, you know, some of the inherent difficulties in creating a new profession in the NHS, and then talk about the creation of healthcare science and why we needed to do it, and then talk about the project itself and how we did it. And then very quickly at the end, just touch on the role that COVID played in shining a light on healthcare scientists and then the impact of MSc, modernising scientific careers and the future. So let's have a look at who they are. So if you start by asking, how do you get diseases diagnosed? So I've got pictures of three different patients here, one with chest pain, one with some leg pain, and a lady who could, anything could be wrong with her. You know, she could be having a bad day at work, or she could be very fatigued, or she could have an infection. Whatever the reason, these three people end up going to their GP, and the GP will have a word with them, they will be examined, but almost certainly, 9 times out of 10, they'll have a blood test. So blood will be taken, and the blood will go off into a series of different laboratories. And once the laboratory's done the test, the lab tests are sent back to the doctor, and the doctor will talk to either one of those patients and give them a diagnosis, or a potential diagnosis. But what happens in the laboratory? Well, these are just pictures of all the different kinds of laboratories that I mentioned, immunology, biochemistry. But if you look at what happened in the lab, that lab consists entirely of scientists. There are no doctors, no nurses, no pharmacists there. Healthcare scientists did the correct test on that patient. Healthcare scientists are trained to interpret the results of those tests. If they find something odd in the first test, they probably be very likely going and do a secondary test and maybe even a tertiary test. They don't need to ask anybody's permission to do that. They are clinically trained to understand what those results mean. And before they send them back to the doctor, they'll make sure that they've got, you know, exactly what they think that GP needs. And indeed, there's a constant dialogue all the time between, in these cases, the pathology scientists, between pathology scientists and all sorts of scientists and the GPs or indeed hospital doctors. So scientists, although we don't know about them, they constantly talk to doctors and to nurses because it's very important that they do. So the diagnostic process involves doctors and nurses, but it critically involves healthcare science. And most people have no idea that they've ever even met a healthcare scientist or that that healthcare scientist has been involved in their diagnosis. And if we just carry on with this, take one of these patients now, he'll have had some blood tests, the chap with chest pain, but almost certainly they'll want to do, explore, has he got a respiratory problem or a cardiac problem? So he'll go off and have respiratory and cardiac tests. And again, results go back to the doctor, and the doctor will give him, or you know, will relay to him what the diagnosis or potential diagnosis is. But if you look at who did those tests, respiratory tests and cardiac tests can be very, very complex, but they are performed, they are analysed, they are interpreted, and the results are given back to the doctor by healthcare scientists, not by anybody else. And so what you might be surprised to know is that 8 times out of 10, and that's minimum, at least 8 times out of 10, any diagnosis, almost any diagnosis is going to be made in health, will have been made by, or at least will critically involve, a healthcare scientist. Yet, all people know about are the doctors and the nurses who gave them that result. And this is a kind of a cartoon of the scale and impact of healthcare science. There's about between 55,000 to 60,000 healthcare scientists right throughout the system. They work across 50 different specialisms. For every medical specialty you've got, you will have somewhere sitting beside them or behind them a healthcare science specialty. And that's because medicine is incredibly scientific, and it's becoming more and more scientific, not less. So they work, you know, the scientists in health use their scientific knowledge to help diagnose, prevent, and treat medicine alongside their colleagues in nursing and medicine and other healthcare professions. I've already told you that 90%, most of them work in diagnostics. Most of them will work in diagnostics, but they quite often work between diagnostics and other areas. And I've already told you that a healthcare scientist's work will be involved in 80% of all patient pathways. Towards the end of tonight, I'm going to say a little bit about COVID. COVID was extraordinary for science, but particularly for healthcare science. You know, science and healthcare science receive great coverage during the pandemic. Obviously, there was the vaccine, but also the development and the delivery of PCR and all the ventilators. I'm going to show you at the very end, they were healthcare scientists that did that. You know, and yet people still don't really understand who this group of people are. I'll tell you a little bit about that at the end. And I've mentioned that there are 50 different specialisms of healthcare science. I don't want this to scare you, but that's just some of, this is probably most of them actually, I've probably captured most of them here. You can divide them into the life sciences, and you'll find them kicking around laboratories largely, the physiological sciences, like the audiologist, the vision scientist, all of the physical sciences, like if you have radiotherapy for whatever disease you're having radiotherapy for, you can't have radiotherapy without a radiotherapy physicist. You've got to be a radiotherapy physicist, who's probably the critical person in that team to work out the dose of radiotherapy you're going to have. And there's a new group of scientists now, and it's nice to see Andy Brass here, because it's Andy's group really here in this university who are really leading teaching of clinical bioinformatics to the healthcare scientists. And they themselves have advocated to spread that message throughout the NHS. So I'm going to come back to these 50 specialisms as we go through. One question that's asked about healthcare scientists is, do they do research? And the answer is yes, they do research. If you look at healthcare, there are two types of scientists. There are the kind of traditional, who we all know, the academic research scientists, and then there are the healthcare scientists who are much, much greater hidden. These guys tend to work predominantly in universities, whereas these guys work in hospitals. But they both do the same thing. They're both trained in science. They both, adopt systematic, logical approaches to their work. They both are aware of, the rigorous need to be controlled. You know, they both teach, they both train. And of course, they both present their data, both in concise scientific journals and also presented at scientific conferences. If you look at an academic research scientist, their main emphasis is an acquisition of knowledge that will expand their field of endeavor. Okay, and they use hypotheses, and their major aim is to publish their work in scientific journals that will, that will really allow their work to get out there and for their research to continue. In some cases, where that research is very applied, such as we saw in the pandemic, then it will have a major societal impact. Nearly all this research will eventually have a major scientific impact, but it's true to say that usually the impact for the kind of research that's done by these academic research scientists, usually takes many years. It may involve in vitro models, and it may involve, sometimes animal models, and there has to be a lot of translational steps before that work makes a big impact in society. It's quite different for healthcare science. The emphasis from a healthcare science point of view, like myself, is we respond, our research responds quickly to an urgent clinical need. We also develop hypotheses, but really our research is informed by clinical need, and we're all the time aware of patients and patient safety, and is it going to work in patients? We also want, our major aim would be to improve patient services and perhaps change clinical guidelines. It's a very interesting fact that more and more and more, we're beginning to claim our intellectual right. We're beginning to write our own papers. We're not hiding behind a medical colleague or a clinical trial. We're beginning now, particularly the STP scientists and HSST scientists, they're beginning to claim their own scientific and intellectual place in the NHS. So the societal impact of our research is immediate. It's small. It may not get published in Nature, but it's very, very important, and it's incremental. And we will be the people that will help to develop new diagnostic tests and help to make sure treatments work. And we also, as I say, we're all clinical. We all have a training in a clinical environment and understand working in the NHS. So that's a romp through who we are. And I hope for some of you that know that, it's giving you a better idea. Trying to create a new profession in the NHS is not that easy. Professionalism can take two different forms. You can have professionalism from above, a government initiative, or you can have professionalism from within. If you want any more detail on this, I'm going to direct you towards my colleague Simon Worley towards the end. But in the case of modernising scientific careers and healthcare scientists developing a profession, it was professionalisation from above. The government supported this, and you'll see why. It's important to realise, I'm going to dip in and back out of this point. If you're trying to create a new profession in the NHS, there are many professions in the NHS, and they will play a role in helping or not helping that profession to develop. And we'll come back to that. And the kinds of people I'm talking about are medical colleagues, nursing colleagues, pharmacists, allied health professionals, managers, et cetera. They'll all play a role. They'll all have a view on a new profession. So for instance, if you look at nurses versus doctors in the last 20 years, nurses have taken on a lot of the territory that used to be occupied by doctors. And it's not been easy. And there's been contested territory and struggle for professionalism, et cetera. And so in the case of a new profession like ours, healthcare science, it's very important for us to assert our professional currency. And it's important that we do that because it will allow us then to, you know, to put forward a positive perception of us as a profession. And I'm not really going to get into it. There's a lot more of this in the chapter. So I want to really come on to talk about the creation of healthcare science. Why is this profession still invisible? Because it really is invisible. So there's some possible reasons. There's a historical lack of a core profession of healthcare science. There are over 50 different professions in healthcare science. That means there's 50 different professional bodies. And I'm going to talk about these again as we go through. And those professional bodies will have competing and divergent interests. That also means that there's 50 different career pathways and 50 different training routes. Well, there isn't any more. But there was up until 15 years ago. Some of these healthcare scientists were brilliantly regulated, but some of them were not regulated. And of course, I've mentioned there are competing interests about developing new professions from the other health professions in the NHS. And if I go back to the question, why is a healthcare science profession invisible? All of these things probably contribute to the lack of visibility of healthcare science, but they lead to a lack of understanding of the importance and the criticality of the work of this group of people to the NHS and to patients. This is just this person sitting here looking very dejected. Could be anyone. It could be 15 years ago, this could be any trainee in any of those 50 professions, or it could be an employer or an employee. You know, the career structure was very inflexible in places. It was very inconsistent. It was incredibly confusing to understand who was funding it, where the commissioning came from. And that's just the career structure. If you look down here at what the training was like, in many cases it was ad hoc, but it certainly wasn't cohesive and it wasn't coherent and it wasn't standardized across all the professions. And these inconsistencies in training and education led to inconsistent pre-registration regimes, which is really dangerous. That's very dangerous for potential patient outcomes. And it's also very difficult to plan a healthcare science workforce. And this is one of the reasons why the government got involved and got behind modernising scientific careers. This is just some of the professional bodies that currently exist. And don't get me wrong, I'm a great fan of professional bodies and we cannot do without them and you really need them. You know, I'm a member of one, I'm an honorary member of another, and you can see the range of science that's done and that these professional bodies take care of. And, you know, professional bodies are very important because they will continue to develop their own professional specialization. But they were interested in modernizing scientific careers, but they were also quite naturally a bit suspicious because they were a bit scared that, you know, they might lose their autonomy. So modernising scientific careers had to be very careful because it was critical to get all the professional bodies on board. Otherwise, this project would not work. And so the modernising scientific careers team, they had to reassure the professional bodies and they had to persuade them that actually the team modernising scientific careers wanted these professional bodies to maintain their individual identity. But in addition to that, we wanted them to get behind modernising scientific careers. And we wanted them to, you know, keep their own identity, but to get together and speak with one voice for healthcare science. And there's two big reasons why that's important. One is politically. Politically, one loud voice is far, far more effective than 50 different voices, no matter how good they were. One voice is much, much better. And secondly, 50 different career and training pathways was just a nightmare. It was particularly difficult because all these different career pathways and training pathways existed in a hospital. You know, our colleagues in nursing and medicine, no idea. They had nothing to compare, you know, people on different stretches of that career pathway with. They couldn't align, you know, who this healthcare scientist was. That's very, very important that you're very open and transparent with your career pathway and your screening pathway. And it was even more important to let the managers and trusts and chief executives and trusts understand that too. So let's move on now to modernising scientific careers. You know, there's been chief scientific officers throughout the years, and they've all tried to tackle this problem, and with varying degrees of success. But I think it's true to say that it wasn't until Dame Professor Sue Hill, who's the current chief scientific officer, until she really had a vision and she got together a strategy and she made this happen about 15 years ago. So it was Sue's office, the office of the chief scientific officer within NHS England. At that time, it could even be the Department of Health. It was her office that led on the development of professionalising healthcare science to one profession. And she was supported by the government in doing so. And it's very interesting why the government got behind that. I've indicated some of the reasons to you. But there are four, but three of them are on this slide, and the next one's on the next slide. Firstly, the government, but by getting behind healthcare science, they were signaling to the public that they take public health really seriously. Secondly, by getting behind modernising scientific careers, it would give them greater control over healthcare science. It would give them an understanding of their occupations, of their regulation, of decisions that they might make, because all that has an impact on money and public spending. And then the third reason was it provided the government with a critical way to understand these professions and to adapt to the workforce shortages that otherwise they were finding it very difficult to understand. A fourth reason is shown here. It's just a fact that scientific advances happen all the time. You can't stop it. And scientific advances have and are and will transform healthcare. I mean, you can just see some of the different transformations and technologies that we're all using now that affect the healthcare that either we've all undertaken or our friends or family have. And so the implementation of these scientific innovations into patient pathways are just going to continue, and they're going to underpin the development of new diagnostic tests and safe diagnostic tests and also treatments for patients. So for all of these reasons, the government got behind modernising scientific careers, and it resulted in 2008 in the publication of this document here. So this document was a four-country consultation document. So this is how important the government took it. All the governments in this country got together and got behind this document. So in that document, a very, very interesting document, in that document it talks about the challenges that the country had then and still has now to deliver healthcare for the population of the United Kingdom. And these are all of the things that people expect. It's an understanding that, you know, our problems, our health problems are becoming very, very complex. And it's a huge expectation from the public that, you know, new scientific developments are going to be adopted quickly into health. You know, there's kind of a skipping over the fact they cost a fortune, but you know, they expect them to be there. And these are just some of the services, from genomic services to like the new proton beam therapies for many kinds of cancer, operated and developed all by scientists. So the document made a powerful case for change in the career pathways of the healthcare science workforce, because they were critical to be able to underpin the development of the kind of healthcare that we're going to need in the future. This is another two reasons why that came out of this document. The fact that, you know, these are basically healthcare scientists. Nobody knows who they are. But the fact that nobody knows who the healthcare scientists are adversely affects scientific services in hospitals. And hospitals deliver, whether they realise it or not, they deliver scientific services. And because nobody knows who they are, it means that they're not understood. And if they're not understood by NHS trust boards, it means they're not supported by NHS trust boards. And because the NHS trust boards don't know about them, it's actually really hard for trusts to effectively deliver scientific services and technological advances effectively and efficiently. And these are two really, really important points that are kind of almost kind of hidden in that document, but they're very, very important points. I'll pause for a second and say, if you look at modernizing scientific careers, in my view, it's the very definition of a wicked problem. It's very complex issues, really, really difficult. And in order for Sue Hill and her team to deliver modernizing scientific careers, they were going to have to be really good. She was going to have to be a really good leader, and she's going to have to build around it a really good team of followers. So this is what Sue did. She did that. She assembled a team of, you know, expert scientists, but they weren't just scientists. There were medical doctors. There were people who were experts in regulation, experts in accreditation. There were people who, you know, knew about curricula. There were all sorts of people from universities. Just all the people that would be required. She assembled this very, very good team around her. Together, the core team crafted the policy. They had to devise an education and training framework for those 50 professions that was also able to be flexible and resilient enough to adapt to changes in scientific developments. And they also, they couldn't do it all by themselves, so they had to go out and find other followers, and they had to organize the implementation of this. So the core team crafted the policy, and what they did was they then enabled, they then enlisted the help of a whole other bunch, well over 100, 200 expert NHS trust scientists. I was one of them. And what we did by working with the core team is we worked to develop their policy. And crucially, we did a lot of the practical work. You know, we could give advice about, well, that's not ever going to work in that department, you know, and we could say things like, you know, we could help to socialize the policy, and we could also give quite, you know, quite good intelligence back to the core team to say, this is not landing well, why don't we change that a little bit? And we also helped with the curriculum and all sorts of things like that. So there was a great big team of followers who also themselves were leaders. And it was that group of people, well, everybody together really, who basically socialized and got this policy delivered into all those trusts up and down the country. So the policy proposal, the proposals themselves were then finally published in 2010 in this document, which again was a four-country document. And England has really run with this, and so has Wales, and but everybody's done it in their own way. So Scotland and Northern Ireland have done it in their own way. And the respondents from that consultation document all agreed that, you know, that it was very important. You know, all those professional bodies agreed that actually, although they might not like it, there were a few grumbles, they actually all agreed that it was really important to have this cohesive training pathway and a single career pathway. Everybody agreed that regulation was very, very important. And everybody agreed that scientists needed to develop clinical leadership abilities, which is where the University of Manchester and HSST came in. Everybody agreed that scientists should take their own, they should take professional responsibility and acknowledgement for innovation. And to a person, we all think that scientists have to learn how to communicate much better. Scientists are not good communicators. We kind of love to kind of, you know, we're all geeks really at the end of the day. I mean, we like to kind of stay in our laboratories at our departments, and we love using quite complicated language that only we understand. And so we have to change that. So what came out of modernizing scientific careers was the creation of two major organizations. One was the Academy of Healthcare Science, and this was to assist in the regulation and the cohesion of those professional bodies. And the other was the National School of Healthcare Science to deliver the education and training framework that would underpin that career framework. And we'll talk a little tiny bit about them now. And these are just Janet Muffin, who's the CEO of the Academy. And there have been three heads of the National School. Val was a geneticist, and Chris was a medical physicist, and I'm an immunologist. So we're slowly working through the 50 professions at the head of the school. So if you look at the Academy, its idea was it was jointly funded by the Department of Health and those professional bodies. And it's, you know, it wanted to create professional authority that would give some legitimacy to healthcare science. And one of the most important things that it was tasked with was developing healthcare science registers, and particularly those registers, we wanted them to be accredited by the Professional Standards Authority. And that's definitely been done. In fact, all of the paths have been done. You know, there have been common standards for healthcare science. And very importantly, the Academy oversees the assessment of equivalence, because obviously not everybody could take these training pathways, and there's lots of scientists who currently work in the trust who want to kind of come on board. And very importantly too, because the academy was set up with the professional bodies, there's a professional body council to speak with one voice for healthcare scientists. So the career pathway was set up. I'm not going to get into this pathway in great details, except to say that it was set up so you had run through career pathway from level two right up to doctoral level here. And to underpin that new healthcare science career pathway, the National School of Healthcare Science was set up. And its intended role was to implement and deliver high quality education that would really deliver people into this career pathway. And I think it's true to say that it's been very successful in doing that with the help of people, that people in this room. This is the new education and training framework that grew out of Modernising Scientific Careers. And I think it is a testament to Modernising Scientific Careers that this hasn't changed. This has not changed. It's been so successful and so well thought through that it continues to this day. But what I'm not showing here, because of time, is that, you know, it's very resilient, it's very adaptable, it's very flexible. It lends itself to all sorts of different kinds of training. And so it's a very, very good training program. And the school, the role of the school is to make sure that this is implemented and delivered. I've drawn a circle around this yellow box, which is the box that talks about doctoral training. And I just want to mention, because I'm here in the University of Manchester Business School, we're very, very proud of HSST. And I think it's important for this audience to know that all of our HSST trainees, it is mandatory that they undertake, in fact, they have to achieve the PGDIP in leadership and management. And that has transformed these scientists. It's allowed them to understand different ways of doing this. It's given them the confidence to talk to people in their trust. It's given them the ability and the skill and the knowledge to do that. And so it's a very, very important program, not just because it's delivering high level sciences for the science, but because it's creating leaders and managers out of our scientists. And we're very, very grateful for the collaboration we have with you guys in doing that. This is just, I'm just going to, you mentioned it, Anne, beforehand, this is the STP program. I just showed you we started here with 14 different scientific disciplines. We're now up to 31. That incorporates probably more than 31 but out of the 50. And we're well up to maybe 530 or 540. So the numbers are really increasing year on year. And in HSST, you're never going to have as many HSSTs. And in fact, the stumbling block with HSST isn't the ability to take them onto the programme, it's the fact that there's not enough scientists out there to train them at that very high level. But, you know, we'll get there. We're quite sure we'll get there. And so in my last, it was conscious of this football match, I think I've got a few minutes. You're winning?
Who's winning?
I have the faintest idea. I'm stopping, so thank goodness it's nothing to do with me. COVID was really important for science, really, really important. You know, we all heard about it. You had to follow the science. And actually, healthcare science, a lot of healthcare scientists are like key governmental aides and policymakers. And that's because of the vital role that they played in combating the pandemic. And these are just two slides. I just want to celebrate the clinical engineers and the medical physicists and the physiologists. These guys, nobody knows about them, but these guys delivered the ventilators. They really did. I mean, I'm aware of time, but they had to get a big, big kind of factory kind of warehouse in Nottingham and get all these ventilators from all over the world, most of which didn't work, and they had to adapt them all. And then they had to sort them all out in all the different hospitals around the country. It was an extraordinary challenge. So you wouldn't have had, without them, the procurement, the installation, you can read it there. It just wouldn't have happened without the clinical engineers. And all those key, those hospitals, those field hospitals, needed the medical physicists and the physiologists. And take a look at that picture there. That's all science and technology. And it's these guys that really were key to delivering that. And the pathology scientists, the unsung heroes, really, they not only developed the COVID test, they performed them on tens of millions of people. And they continue to do so today as part of their routine job. And the genetic pathology scientists, they all throughout the pandemic, they work with microbiologists who are also pathology scientists, but they work with their research colleagues and they identify these variants of concern. And they quickly develop tests to test for them. And without them, the procurement, operation, maintenance, etc., of the tests that were done in COVID just wouldn't have happened. So I'm on to the very last few slides now. Just to assess the impact of modernising scientific careers, there's probably three different things that they'll assess the impact. If you look at modernising scientific careers as a case study in leadership and followership, it's a great example of the interdependence of leadership and followership. It's a brilliant example. You had stable leadership at the top. Sue has been there since 2002. She had a really clear strategic vision, but she also assembled this great team. She had an appropriate group of experts, and they believed in the project and they wanted it to succeed, and they got other people to join them in. So it was to join in with them rather. And that's why it was very effective in achieving its aim. Secondly, I think it's been a very interesting project from the point of view of other NESA professions who might want to come into the NHS or grow up in the NHS. And the point I really make about this is that technology and innovation is changing so fast, and it's coming into a health service that is just, you know, screaming out for money. It's cash starved. And what that is meaning is that it's no longer the case that any just one profession can hold the ring on being the sole keeper of clinical and organizational and systemic change. That just can't happen anymore. We know that, but it's going to take time for that to filter through, but it will filter through. It's a very technological health service that we now have. And healthcare scientists have got it. We have a very distinctive jurisdiction that nobody can really take away from us. So in that case, in that sense, we're quite fortunate. We're very small and we're still not good at communicating about ourselves. But, you know, with respect to diagnosis, we should have a major influence in patient care. And I think the next few years will be very interesting to watch. And the very last point I'll make about the impact of modernising scientific careers is that, you know, by raising our profile, you will improve patient outcomes. It's shown that if you really take care of your scientists, you will deliver better scientific services. You know, employers are recognising our trainees. You know, the people who come out of STP, 85% of them get a job in the NHS. You know, and the others tend to go into industry, but stay in science, in healthcare. That's incredible. And, you know, there are now lead scientists in many trusts in England, and we're hoping to get them, you know, put onto boards, particularly in big trusts. And also they're beginning to work regionally and creating regional networks. So this is my last slide now, really. So in terms of the future, the academy and the school are well established. There is now a career framework, which is underpinned by a very solid training and educational framework. There's still a lot of work needed to raise the profile of healthcare science, and events like this are great. We still need to be going to work more closely with the Office of the CSO in any case, because we're going to merge with that organisation. And I think it's very, very important that there is an external evaluation made of the professionalisation of the MSc project. And I hope that this talk tonight is the first perhaps step in doing so. This is my last slide. So modernising scientific careers, along with COVID, has, you know, the scientific genie is now out of the bottle. And, you know, we see dear old Boris there, you know, but Boris standing, you know, flanked by scientists and medics, he really did enhance the profile of science, and everybody did follow the science. And I think they trust science more. That's my feeling. People trust science more. And my family can actually spell immunology now, which is quite a good thing, you know, and hopefully it will lead to, you know, more people coming into STEM. It will lead to people being less afraid of genomics. And I just think it's a very good thing that's happened. And I think we've got time for questions before the match kicks off. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Emily. That was very, really stimulating presentation. And as a medical sociologist, I'm fascinated at that historical account of the emergence of a new profession. Yeah. And also kind of really interested in what a study might look like that looks at the professional socialisation of healthcare scientists and healthcare scientists into leadership. So thank you. Thank you so much. So I'm going to invite questions from the floor first of all, and also I know Simon's keeping an eye on our colleagues who have joined us online. So if I go with Anne and then Lawrence, and then I'll come to you. Could you please very briefly introduce yourself and then ask your question?
Hi, thanks very much. Really great talk. My name's Anne McBride, and my interest is in employment relations.
Yeah.
So I'm very interested in whether or not the employer or the employment relationship was in that policy in 2010.
Yes.
I'm thinking that, you know, particularly maybe pathologists, I just get the impression that maybe they're vulnerable to outsourcing. So I'm interested in, have I got that right?
Yes.
You know, when they're talking about COVID, it was about privatised labs. So are there some healthcare scientists that have actually been pushed out of the door? And does it matter who employs healthcare scientists?
Some of the big London hospitals, in fact, some other hospitals too, pathology is quite like the privatisation. Doesn't always work though. You know, it really doesn't always work, because at the end of the day, you're talking about medicine. It's not, you know, it's not the same thing as some other businesses. So you do have privatisation of some of the pathology labs, but they tend to stay within the hospital and be run by private organisations within hospitals. So there's a number of hospitals just at that in London. During the COVID, you're quite right, at the very beginning, a lot of the tests, there's a lot of, it's true that some of the tests were done privately in big kind of lighthouse laboratories. Partly that's because there were so many tests that were required to be done, but a lot of tests were done in hospitals as well, and now still quite a lot still get done in hospitals. And certainly in terms of the vaccine, in terms of looking at the various things, a lot of them were done, they had to be done in the NHS. So it's an interesting question. I thought you meant in terms of, we definitely spoke to NHS providers and things like that. They were involved with all of this policy at the very beginning. Everybody was involved with this policy in the beginning and were part of that consultation document if you wanted to have a look at it.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for this.
Thanks so much, Evelyn.
That was a really helpful talk, and Lauren Spence, one of the team on HST.
Oh, good.
Because three of us happen to be marking and Simon, so thanks for that. My dad was a chemist. He spent most of his life saying, I'm a chemist, I'm not a pharmacist, I'm a chemist, you know, an academic chemist.
Yeah.
But I, near the end of your presentation, and you know, the very brave, courageous scientists who did their bit to help the station get through COVID. Have any of them been honoured in the Queen's or Charles's?
I think certainly they've been honoured by the NHS. I think a few of them were. I really can't remember though whether the scientists have been or not. Don't know the answer to that.
That might help on the visibility.
Yeah.
I'm
pretty positive they are. I just don't know their names.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure that they have been. I'll find out and get back to you.
Do you have any kind of stars who appear on telly to talk about healthcare science?
No, we don't. You know, we don't have anybody like that. Again, that tends to be, you know, during the COVID, it was Andy Pollard who came and spoke to the HSST, so if you'll remember, but he came and spoke to the HSST trainees. But you know, that's the kind of hook that would be really brilliant when you get,
right.
And then with the 50 different professions, some of them do really fascinating things. All of the MRIs, you know, all of the proton beam therapies, these are really interesting. There's some amazing like CAR T therapies at Dundine and Great Ormond Street. It would be very good. So if any of you know any, what to commission a documentary on healthcare science.
Okay.
Thank you. Like, if you could briefly introduce yourself.
I'm Tony Johnson. I was a governor at that's Stockholm Foundation Trust. What I'm interested in is the importance of the timely diagnosis of conditions. And what I'd like to really know is there a monitoring of each hospital so that you can actually see what how much better some hospitals are than others, and they could learn from each other. I mean, it's
yeah, there's some work being done by a guy in Oxford who's very interested in health informatics. This is where health informatics comes in, because in order to do that, you need to be, that's really gigantic data we're talking about, and you have to be able to control that.
it's on its way, is what I'd say. I know certainly that Ben Goldacre has done a study looking at antibiotics from all the different GPs, use of antibiotics in different GPs around the country, and he can look at differences and why that is, which is the kind of study I think you're alluding to.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem that many people have is that in Greater Manchester, health and social care was devolved to Greater Manchester 7 years ago with a budget of £6.3 billion. And we've had no savings identified from quick wins or synergies. And I think that it's not just a matter of saying we're not getting enough money from the government. It's a matter of having devolved that there should be local responsibility in Greater Manchester. But I don't see any sense of that at all. Or if you go to an AGM of a foundation trust, it's good news stories. Back in Stockport, we've got a very old laboratory. The roof, it's been repaired, leaks in, been leaking, and very narrow corridors. So I'm trying to realise, what are we doing in Greater Manchester to actually address the issues and actually do something about social care and actually develop and build more sheltered accommodation, because too many people are being sent to the nursing homes because there aren't the facilities, and there hasn't been any kind of planning to ensure that we try and keep people out of nursing homes. That doesn't seem to exist.
Yeah, in terms of healthcare science, we tend to work more, as I said, one of the slides should be, tend to work predominantly in the acute sector, and we work mainly in diagnosis. I think we perhaps wouldn't be so involved in kind of taking patients from hospitals into the social care sector. But in terms of understanding that, the clinical bioinformaticians will be the ones that will actually start to organise that. And that's a very new profession. And it's just beginning. So I think watch this space is what I'd say.
But we are 7 years down the road from delegation to Greater Manchester, and there hasn't been that responsibility.
Okay. Kieran, do you want to respond to that, or have you got a separate question? Okay, just bear with me one moment. Can I just ask Simon if you could see if there's any questions from colleagues who've joined us online?
So we've got two questions. This one I've asked for the person's name, but we don't know. So this is a question from social media. Can the UK learn any best practices from other countries in how we train healthcare scientists? Because you put forward the case about how it's revolutionised here, but what about learning from elsewhere?
I think that's really interesting. And to the best of my knowledge, I think we're ahead of curve. And if there's anybody doing it the way we do it. I mean, nobody's got everybody together like this, and kind of really undertaken that. You can see, I mean, I've done it really quickly, but this has been major to do this. I mean, very well organised, and I don't know. I mean, Canada is the only country I've heard of that does something like this, but it's not as good.
Andy, did you want to?
Well, I'd say, well, there's absolutely some big work going on behind this. Also, there's the Toronto, Melbourne, engineer, so there's a lot of work where actually people are very keen to learn what's going on in their own time. And this idea of how you actually translate science so it makes a real difference to real patients. I genuinely don't have a lead on that here, just to work with health care scientists. So that is something that I think is unique to the UK.
It's very true that, I mean, I was kind of half looking, but it's true. I mean, I think that it's been an extraordinary experiment that's worked quite well, but still very young.
Great, okay, and one more.
Well, the person actually replied to say, Bernie's touched on the question, and I think it was really about short another pandemic, what can we do to increase the awareness of the profession? So I don't know whether you wanted to kind of talk a bit more about that.
It's hard, it's hard to do that. We're doing it, it's basically what I say. It's slow, and I think it will be exponential. I was talking to somebody saying, once the HSST start to come out, you build up an alumni of HSST, you're already building up an alumni of STPs. You need these people because it takes confidence. And I was a trust lead scientist. It's really not for the faint-hearted to be a trust lead scientist and to keep piping up about healthcare science. So it's you need a community of people around the country, and eventually have a critical mass of people in trust who'll be able to talk about this. We'll always be small. We'll always be small, and I think it's very important. And another thing is that I think I pointed out some of the obstacles, perhaps from other professions. They don't mean to be obstacles, but you know, I think, and I don't see that they are. I mean, health is so scientific now. It's growing so fast that there's room for all of us there, not always seen us as allies to other professions, not contesting territory. I see us as helping one another out.
Great. Okay, thank you. You had your hand back.
My name's Paul Rowe from Clinical Scientists at MRI and HNI, and also the chair of the training directorate in Vichy and an HNST graduate, so trifecta there. So my question kind of leads on from Lawrence's internet question, but something we've noticed is doctors taking credit for our work. So I work in HNI, so I work in transplantation, and a few years ago, I don't know if you remember, there was a BBC documentary that was all about following transplants and the donor to the patient. And this documentary, either tissue typing with doctors, finding donors with doctors, the ODT apparently could just send letters to people. So it was very much either you feel like your job's either being pushed aside and ignored, or someone else takes the credit because, like you say, they're the ones giving you diagnosis, they're the ones being in the room to give professional advice to documentary makers. Mm. So the question is, how do we get in that room so other people don't speak for us?
I said it there. I mean, one of the things to do, and I've experienced this. Yeah, so when I was running the lab, you know, I wrote a policy, you know, I sent it to all the doctors, and I said, if you want to use our work in the laboratory, you have to acknowledge us, and we're going to be on that paper, otherwise you're not going to be able to use our work, you know, and you literally have to be that. And that's not easy to do. I'm telling you, it's not easy to do, but you have to make a stand. And I think, I really genuinely believe that with all the HSSTs that are coming out, and once they start to have that confidence, and also, I really mean it, they need the knowledge, the skills to be able to communicate and to be leaders. It's going to take time, but asking questions like that, being aware of questions like that, learning how to deal with that kind of situation is what to do. Because mainly, I think in the past, scientists have just kind of scurried backwards and let that happen. And I think that's happening less and less and less now. I do.
Great. Thank you. I know there was one more. Stuart, did you have your no, Kayleigh. Sorry, Martin.
Really interesting presentation. I was reflecting listening to you a long time ago when I was hospital manager. Never went into the lab, and nobody ever came out. It was a bit like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. In there's this bunch of people doing stuff that they were. Yeah. So you've come a really long way. The question I've got is to do with the proliferation of diagnostic technologies and the way we regulate them and understand them, do you think that's fit for purpose? So a couple of examples. We are rushing into whole genome sequencing for newborns on the basis of a really limited evidence base, and where there are some profound concerns about the unintended and adverse consequences of whole genome sequencing. Lots of examples, which I could go into. We're launching a big project called Our Future Health, which aims to do limited genomic sequencing for 5 million people in this country, and makes a bunch of assertions about polygenic risk scores and things like that. And I'd be interested in your views about that. The other example I'd cite, I suppose, would be the GRAIL work, where we're taking a technology for early cancer detection, which looks promising, but which hasn't been terribly well researched, and we're rushing into kind of combination of service evaluation and rollout in England and Wales. Now, in all of those, are the professionals, the scientists, actually playing the role they should as professionals, which is in managing and speaking up for the careful, proper researching and evaluation of diagnostic technologies? You said on one of your slides that, you know, we really take a big role in that diagnostic space. Well, as professionals, isn't it your job to ask some of those difficult questions?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know personally in detail about either any of the three things you've mentioned, although I do know about them. Mm. I mean, as an immunologist, I'm aware of introducing, for instance, in newborn babies, looking for, but they were, there wasn't whole genome sequence, so it was just looking for certain immunodeficiencies, which I didn't think such a bad thing because, you know, there's so many of them. And so that was, I think that's quite useful, but that's better research in the immunodeficiency world. As to the, I don't know enough about it to be able to make an argument one way or other for each of those, for any of those particular technologies. But in terms of what you ask about healthcare science, we absolutely should be involved. All of us should be at that table. And what would worry me would be that it would be led by quite powerful research, and also particularly all the science nowadays is also driven by this lot of connection, which there should be with industry. But you need to have that really rigorous diagnostic reproducibility of tests, and is it robust enough? That was one of the problems that people had perhaps with some of the tests that were rushed out early on in the pandemic. But you have to be very careful about that. So I agree with you, and I hope that at the table, I mean, it doesn't come into my area in terms of training and development, but I certainly hope that healthcare scientists are being asked those questions across the board in those three areas, because they should be.
Okay, thank you. Martin, and I beg your pardon.
Just to point that, because the clinical background is now doing it quite well, and I think it will change. Yeah. But we're only just at the point where the first of our HSST trainees has actually become an informatics lead. So I think that's just so early in the public. Having that voice at the table is only just starting. But interestingly, like someone that Nathan knows well, some of the training here about the leadership, that's really important. But they're only just getting started now. So although it's been 10 years on, actually getting the people to have that voice at the table, there's still work to be done there.
Yeah, and I get unnoticed in HGE, and we weren't really involved in HGE. We're now at all of the different tables. And I think we're getting there. You know, we're such a small profession. People are very impressed by this, though. They're really impressed, you know, because, and so that's a good thing because we've done this quite well. And people are thinking, oh, okay, that's quite good. Other professions have got their own idiosyncrasies. So we have done quite well. We are beginning to sit at these tables, but it's going to take time.
Okay. So Martin, and then we may have time for one more on that.
Martin Rassel, I'm a patient representative by the commissioning end of the NHS therapy. I keep hearing that we're going to have community diagnostic centres all over the place.
Yes. I keep hearing that too.
They're moving rather slow, actually. Yeah. But the question that I get from your picture, how much do your scientists actually communicate directly with patients?
Mm-hmm. It depends on the profession. I mean, as the chaps at the research have said, in the labs, they tend not to communicate with patients. But physicists, they communicate with patients all the time, but the patient wouldn't know they're a scientist. Mm-hmm. Physiologists run their own clinics. Hematologists and transfusion are running their own clinics now. I mean, it really is changing. I mean, I was at a meeting the other day with the Royal College of Pathologists all about transfusion medicine. And, you know, this is so much work for hematologists to do now that they can't do it all. And so some of the consultant clinical scientists are beginning to triage those patients. Again, I agree with what a number of people have said, is it's early on. So give us another 10 years. And I think it'd be really interesting to do this talk again and see how far we've come, and you know, with the questions you've got in mind, you know, see if you can address some of them.
I would like to say a massive thank you.
Really.
It's been a great lecture.
So on behalf of the school, once again, I'd like to say a big, huge thank you to Bernie for taking the time to come to speak to us this evening, for starting such an interesting discussion, also to Anne for facilitating that discussion. And then once again, thank you for joining us today, and particularly to Bernie for such an interesting talk. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you found this episode insightful. For a list of our latest webinars, news, and useful business content, please visit ambs.ac.uk.